Calling all units, calling all units. Donut shop has a fresh dozen. Go ahead and take a 1040.
All right, I'm going to talk to this camera. Welcome, everybody, back to the Donut Shop Podcast. First episode for me, flagshipping this and being the host. So welcome back, and thanks for checking out the Donut Shop Podcast. On this episode, I'm welcoming Sergeant Bert Maverick Gonzalez. I just wanted to read it off of the book because he has a book out, and reached out to me and wanted to have him on the show. So, and we've talked at length prior to the show, and I'm excited because I don't think I paid for enough time here at this donut shop for the two of us to talk, because I know we're gonna have some good conversations. So welcome, Bert.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Let me just turn up your mic a little bit, or just pull it a little bit closer to you, and then make sure we pick it up. Cause if I give it too much gain, then we're going to pick up all the children walking in. Cause we are here at a Dunkin'. I'm going to say it. They're not sponsoring it, but welcome. We're here at a Dunkin'. The donut shop is actually at a donut shop.
Where most cops go.
Yeah. So cheers and welcome.
Thank you.
Dead air for those listening in podcast land. So we'll get right to it. You retired. How long ago did you retire?
Four years ago.
So still very fresh retirement from Miami-Dade County.
I'm still very connected because I have family there. My son, who's a sergeant. My niece, Alina, who's a lieutenant. My son's wife, Michelle, who's a robbery detective. And of course, my old friends and colleagues and my old partner, Sergeant Tony Corbin, is at the airport. So I'm still very connected, and I still do a little bit of teaching there for Baker Act.
Oh, okay.
At the training bureau. But
good. Baker Act. Yeah, I mean, it's a hot topic today. And I know that was also a topic in the book that I read.
Yeah. And I'm never going to be that far away from it because we're not. Even though I'm in retirement and I'm more detached now, I'm still concerned about what goes on in the department. I'm still concerned what goes on in law enforcement in general around the country. But also for my friends and colleagues and my family that are still there.
Yeah. And being that it's Miami-Dade, it's not a small department that is able to hide from news and able to stay out of the news. It's such a large department, one of the largest in the nation, covers only law enforcement, right? They don't have their actual, they're not running the jails kind of thing, right?
So what's unique about Miami-Dade County in that sense, where as most people know that the sheriff's departments run the jails in most counties, and in all the other 66 counties in Florida, that's the way it's done. In Miami-Dade County, and even when it was called Dade County, the jail had its own corrections department, Miami-Dade Corrections or Dade County Corrections, which was good for us because Miami-Dade Police is the sheriff of Miami-Dade County.
Yeah.
But it's two separate departments, where in some sheriff's departments, they make you work corrections first and then go out to the police side, which I didn't want to do and I didn't have to.
Yeah.
So that was good. So we liked the separation of the two departments.
Oh, okay. And then we've learned through a previous Donut Shop podcast with Mario Knapp on here that come later this year, there's going to be the election for sheriff, and that's going to be a bit of a change as far as administratively, I think, for Dade County.
First time since 1956, I think, when Dade County adopted the Home Rule Charter. They petitioned Tallahassee to run their own show in Dade County because, as we know, Dade County is different than the rest of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
A bit of corruption. Yeah. At the time.
Yes. Yeah. I've always said that all cities in the country, no matter New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, wherever it may be, everybody has their version of corruption, right? Because it's politics. The difference with ours is that in our glasses, we have little umbrellas.
Yes, they're much nicer drinks.
Yes,
they're vacation style drinks, so
right.
it's a little more fun. So I didn't actually write that in my notes, but when did you pick up the badge and gun and join Miami-Dade Police Department?
1983.
All right. Well, for those of you that know my age, I'll leave that to about the one year mark of my life. I appreciate your time, the entirety of my life working as a police officer, almost the entirety of my life. So that's awesome. And there's so much change in South Florida over that span of time that I'm sure you got to see, and you got to see the development of South Florida and the growth of South Florida, and then, you know, change, good for bad, whatever it might be.
We as a department, Metro-Dade Police at the time, and like I put on the cover of my book, Metro-Dade Police instead of Miami-Dade, because those of us that came on at that time still like our old name.
Of course. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Just before that in 79, it was the Public Safety Department, and before that was the Sheriff's Office, right?
So yeah, yeah.
There's always evolution and change. But when I came on, the department and the City of Miami Police Department had to grow exponentially because of the drugs, the cocaine cowboys, because of the Mariel boat lift,
right?
Because Dade County was exploding in population and in crime. So we were hiring left and right, whereas today it might take a year, even up to 2 years, for somebody to get hired. I got hired in 7 months, and having a Latin surname really benefited me at the time, right? My brother, 2 years later, Pete, came out of the Army and got hired in 6 months. So he started his process while he was still in, pending his discharge from the Army, and he was a military policeman. And his wife at the time was a military policeman, and she came out and became a dispatcher, Sally, and then later on became a police officer, and now she's retired, just like my brother and I. Mm-hmm. But we had to grow so fast that some slipped through the cracks, in the background investigations, as you know.
Yeah.
City of Miami was notorious for some of the hiring practices they had at the time. And they had the river cops.
Right. Yeah.
So we're just as bad as the drug dealers. Mm-hmm. But the time of the cocaine cowboys for us, and this is going to sound weird to the non-law enforcement audience, it was a great time to learn how to be a cop. Mm. We had a blast. Now, I'm going to say this, and I get raised eyebrows when I say this to non-law enforcement. We were finding bodies every day. Every day.
Yeah.
Trunks of cars on the side of the road, home invasions where they were posing as cops and got in and killed rival drug dealers and things like that. And for us, as long as you're not in the gunfight, right?
Yeah.
For any cop, it's not good to be in a gunfight. I don't care, you know, you want to think you're Clint Eastwood or something like that? No.
It's not as fun as TV or the movies.
No,
for sure.
Not at all. But for us, it would be, okay, we got another one. Call the Sarge, call homicide, crime scene, and rope it off or tape it off, and it's just another one. And Justin, when I tell you that every day in the Southwest District, which is now the Kendall area of Miami-Dade County, it's where a lot of the higher-level drug dealers lived because there was property out there.
Right.
And then they built ranches out there in what we call horse country, west of the turnpike. So that's where they did a lot of their business, and that's where they did a lot of their hits. And every day, and that's not an exaggeration.
Were there airfields and stuff out there where they would do drops and everything? Because I remember, I've grown up in Western Broward County my whole life, and I remember, you know, whatever tales of a landing strip or an airstrip out off of like Sterling, kind of way out west, Southwest ranches. And yes, when you look at it on a Google map, you're like, oh, that's where it was or whatever. And that was just one of the places that they were able to swoop into Broward County or just low fly the edge of the Everglades and do drops.
Absolutely.
Stuff. Yeah.
during that time, I worked on our Southwest District Crime Suppression Team, as we know, CST.
Okay.
So you do plain clothes. And even though we had our narcotics unit, we did a lot of street-level narcotics. All the CSTs and all the districts did street-level narcotics. And then when we came across a big case, we'd have to turn it over to narcotics, right?
Okay.
So there was this one case where our team was working driveway robberies east of US 1, which is now considered Pinecrest.
Okay.
And all the way to Old Cutler Road, which is a very wealthy area. People were getting robbed in their driveways, being followed home from Bloomingdale's and Dadeland and Burdine's and Neiman Marcus, and they would get hit in their driveways.
Yeah.
Because they had some money and they had nice cars. So one night we recruited extra officers because we needed the manpower. So Mark Silva and I were driving Southwest 148th Terrace. This is December of 85. Looking for driveway robbers, right? Mm-hmm. And unmarked cars. And it was about 8 o'clock. It was dark. Mark and I are driving slowly down this street, and we see two guys at the front door. One of them's looking in the window on the side. We went down. I made a U-turn. We didn't see a car anywhere, and we came back, and they were gone. Very suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark and I decided to pull in the driveway and sit on the house for a little while.
For sure, yeah.
And we called in the rest of the team. We said, this is what we got. So we set up a surveillance, and we're watching for a little while. Nothing was happening. So then we decided to go knock on the door. And one of our guys, Joe Fernandez, had the gift of gab, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he knocked on the door. Mark and I went around the back, and we're looking in the back through the Florida room, as we call it, right? You know, the family room in the back.
For those of you not in Florida, it's like kind of like a patio for some of you, but it's a patio that you sort of sometimes convert into a room and put windows and stuff to extend your house, but it's a big open area.
So right.
Continue on, sir.
So Joe knocks on the door, and he gets a woman, relatively young, but with a couple of children. And he starts questioning her, and he asks her about the two gentlemen that were at the door. And she said, there was nobody here.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. He goes, are you sure? So he radios to us, or one of the other guys radios to us, and says, she says nothing about the two men. I said, well, Mark and I are staring at them inside the Florida room on the couch with the kids. Okay.
Yeah.
So Joe worked his way into the house. We sat her down. We took the two guys into custody to hold them while we were doing our investigation. Joe got her to sign a consent to search. So we searched the house. We found in one of the closets Mac 11 machine guns,
mm-hmm.
suitcases with coffee grounds in them, mm-hmm. to throw off the scent of the dogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
The acetylene torch tanks.
Yeah.
Those were used for the drops in the Everglades that you were mentioning, right? And then we found a garbage bag with $1,300,000 in cash in it, right? And then next to it was a little card table with a ledger book on it, and it was all in code.
Mm-hmm.
We got into the attic, 208 keys of coke. So at that time was the biggest seizure in Dade County.
Yeah.
That's been eclipsed by tonnage over the years, but at the time it was a big deal. So what we learned, we sent the ledger book to the DEA. They broke the code, and it was a triangle between Milan, Italy, Colombia, and Miami.
Wow.
And the family was a husband, wife, and three kids that were put in that house, renting it to live like a family, but that's where they were funneling all the drugs.
Yep.
Right. And it's just one little story of many at the time. It was all over the place.
Yeah, I had a similar, I mean, I didn't have inside knowledge. It was just neighborhood gossip. But a friend of my brother's was one of those families like that. But it was in our neighborhood where we live, and in Western Broward. And it was two houses right across from each other. And the DEA hit it the one time. And my brother saw his friend at school, and he's like, hey, yeah, we're moving. You know, and they were just, they had to move. You know, they were part of it, and his dad was kind of obviously like deeper into it. But, you know, this is just neighborhood gossip, so we didn't know very much. But we met the people that moved in the house later on and told them, you know, yeah, the DEA raided that house. And they were like, kind of makes sense, because there's a lot of hidden walls within this house and hidden compartments and stuff like that. That same sort of thing, like that place to hide kilos, and
right.
You know, and that they were some of the only houses in the neighborhood that had the wrought iron fences and concrete walls and on the outside edges, you know, just to make it a little more difficult for somebody to probably break in, and
right.
You know, so they were a little advanced in their time in the 80s of neighbors that 80s and early 90s neighbors that had walls and big fences and stuff. So that was the reason why they had that.
And the cameras.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Cameras,
cameras were telltale back then.
Yeah. Unheard of in the neighborhoods and stuff because they were expensive and they were bulky. And just as we know today, storage is at a premium. So imagine back then, you know, different scales. So,
right.
But yeah, those are probably definitely things as a street crimes officer, detective that driving around, you could see that stuff and it kind of red flags for sure.
You would pick up on it immediately. We also had another thing we called working the payphones. Mm-hmm. So before my team transitioned to plain clothes, we were in uniform. So we were in the green and whites, the mm-hmm. Metro Day green and whites. But we had an area near a shopping center, Miller Square, where, remember when we used to have banks of payphones everywhere?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we would work the phones. We would park binoculars and watch people with a roll of quarters putting quarters in the payphones, uh-huh. right? Well, that was a telltale sign that it's a drug dealer. He's calling Colombia or long Bogota distance, yeah. or something, right? So when they were done, we would follow them. We would stop them, do a search of the car, find a key, half a key, and a gun. Okay. Then we would inquire about their immigration status because they were all here illegally. Where's your passport? Oh, I don't have one. Call Border Patrol. They would come out. We find out where they lived. Now, Border Patrol immigration did not need a warrant to go in their house because they're here illegally. So they would go in. We would find more drugs and everything. They would take the bodies, and we would take the drugs,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it was all legal search, search incident to arrest,
yeah.
right? So we did that a lot also. But, you know, you couldn't throw a rock without hitting a drug dealer at that time.
Oh, man.
And most of the money, my understanding was that 90% of the money was tainted with cocaine at the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it just flowed everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a scene in one of my favorite cult movies, Scarface,
mm-hmm.
where you see the guys walking into the bank with duffel bags full of money.
Right.
Well, Brickell Avenue didn't have that many banks until the cocaine cowboys were in town and banks were popping up everywhere to launder the money, right?
Yeah.
But that was an exaggeration on a true theme, uh-huh. okay? And then funny story. I was assigned at the Port of Miami for a while,
yeah.
Post 9/11. And I had the privilege of working with a whole bunch of people there, customs and border and ICE agents. And then I had the reins handed over to me by one of the other sergeants to do the security plans for TV and movie shoots and naval ship visits.
Mm.
So we had
big special events. Yeah.
Yeah. Big time. So the Navy ships would come in on shore leave, and then I would meet with the weapons officer who was head of security for the vessel. In this case, one of them was a merchant marine vessel, so the captain and first officer are U.S. Navy. Everybody else are civilians, merchant marines.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do is take them out on the town and show them where their sailors can go on shore leave, because they all want to go to Miami Beach, the South Beach, right? To go right across the causeway. And we tell them, this is what you're going to do. Here on the port, it's Miami-Dade police. But outside here, it's Miami police. And over there, it's Miami Beach. And we would show the difference. And if anything happens, call this number. All right? So I took the first officer to Ocean Drive,
mm-hmm.
right, to show him South Beach.
Yeah.
And he, as we're in Ocean Drive, he goes, is this the part where the chainsaw scene takes place,
yeah, yeah.
right, or the place? Yeah. I go, yeah, we're right about here, right? Because we had few outside shots because the movie was actually shot in California, right?
Right.
But the few outside shots you can't duplicate anywhere else, and this was one of them. So I go, yeah, it was right here in this stretch. You know, some of the buildings have changed. He was from Minnesota. He calls his wife because it was their favorite movie, and he goes, honey, I am at the spot where the chainsaw scene took awesome. Place, right? Yeah. I mean, he was giddy like a child. This guy was in his 50s, right?
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun to see how, you know, he's in South Beach now, right? Never been here before.
Yeah.
So it was just funny. Every time the movie comes on, I watch it again.
Yeah.
Because it's so over the top.
Well, I mean, that's like Bad Boys for me, you know, like that was one of the first like pay-per-views that my parents like trusted me to like order when they went out for the night or whatever. And so I ordered Bad Boys, the first one, and loved it. And Friends, we hung out and would quote it and all that kind of stuff. You know, so it was, you know, that was you know, kind of my generation,
right?
You know,
right.
Law enforcement, Miami. You know, none of it's real. None of it actually happens. But
right.
You know, and they're still making them to this day. So that's awesome. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll get right back. Hey, what's up, guys? Just so you know, we created a Donut Shop Podcast Clips channel. Just clips, meat and potatoes. Some of the best parts of each of our episodes are going to be over on that channel. You can go check it out. Hit the link down in our description. Like, follow, and subscribe. All the stuff over on that channel, too. Help us out. We're back from break, and I want to get into, I'll show it to the cameras, the book, The Real Greatest Show on Earth. So tell me about, you know, why, you know, what inspired you to actually put, I mean, and this is a book. This is like I've had college textbooks that were like this. So tell me about it and why.
Well, it is a textbook, so to speak.
Okay.
I'll get into that. But during my career, and I'm sure this has happened to you and yours,
mm-hmm.
the people that we run into on the street, at the homes and the businesses, and I've had quite a few say, with everything you see and do on the job, you should write a book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many cops through history have written books, especially detectives, and they're all homicide stories, you know,
totally, who done
it. Yeah. So that was planted in my brain, and it kind of stayed there for a while. And then I started thinking more about it as I got near retirement. I said, okay, I think I'm going to give this a shot. Now, funny story. In school, I didn't like school. I was a lazy student. And my mother was a school teacher in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
So in order not to let me fail by not doing my book reports, my mother did my book reports.
Awesome.
Right?
Awesome.
So what do? I get a job where all I do is write reports, right?
Dude, I say the exact same thing to people. I talk about it in college where I mapped out my college courses pre-talking to former students of that professor. Did you have to write a report? Did you have to do this? All the classes that I took were the trajectory of not having to write book reports, essays, right. Research papers. And then I joke around when I would teach, like, as a school resource officer, and I'd tell the kids. And then I took a job, just like you said, where all I do is write book reports about people's lives.
Right.
So it's completely parallel, and it's so funny.
Absolutely. We're all the same.
Yeah,
we're all the same. So when I decided to write it, and now, well, you know, it's I would say just 2 years from retirement. What kind of book do I want to write? I don't want to write a whodunit fiction novel mm-hmm. or based on some particular case. With the way things are around the country, the anti-police sentiment and the absolute BS that we see in cop shows mm-hmm. and movies, right? Which very little of it is real. I wanted my book to be a factual account of who we are as cops. And we're all cut from the same cloth. And I don't care if I'm Miami-Dade, your Sunrise, LAPD, NYPD, Chicago, Moab, Utah.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Right?
Which, good time, been there.
Yeah. We hiked in Arches National Park.
Perfect.
And we were in Moab, which is like this big, right? But we're all the same. The cops there are the same as us. We just have more experience because of the volume.
Correct.
So, but what you see on TV and the perception that people have of us, I wanted to do a how-to guide to educate the public as to who we really are. And the way I started writing it was, this is who a police officer is in America, in Canada, Western Europe, because a lot of similarities. And the truths, the absolute unfiltered truths of policing in America, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had to say what's all good about us. I also had to say what's bad about us, you know, mm-hmm. some of the things that we do or get involved in. But it had to be the unfiltered truth. And in my introduction, I said exactly those things. I'm not going to be politically correct. Because
yeah.
that's not who I am, first of all. And the world out on the street is very unforgiving. It's raw. And I wanted to describe that to people. So that was the basis of the book. being a how-to guide for civilians, media, and the young officer who's considering, you know, a career in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I started writing the book. I've read several books from other guys, not in law enforcement, but and I forget his name, forgive me, the Navy SEAL that killed Bin Laden.
Apparently, that's sometimes in dispute.
Yes.
So, yeah.
But he wrote a book called The Operator.
Right.
Now, okay. Whatever the truth behind the whole thing is.
Whether he took the first shot or the sixth shot.
Nobody. But what I did is I needed to learn how to write the book. So I took from his and others kind of like a guide. Mm-hmm. So I started with what was my life story before I became a cop and what led me to want to be a cop. Mm-hmm. And I talked about those things because we all take that similar journey. Mm-hmm. We were all doing something else before we decided on law enforcement. Right. And it doesn't matter whether you went to college or didn't go to college. You came out of the military, which is huge, right? Mm-hmm. Many, many people from the military, like my brother, transition into law enforcement. It's a natural transition.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of structure and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's how I did it. And then I wanted to decide on the topics, you know, choose the topics that I wanted to talk about most prevalent in the life of a police officer. So, of course, after your recruiting process and the exams you take to get in and the background investigations done on all of us comes the academy. So I wanted to talk about what the academy was really like, mm-hmm. right? Police academy movies are funny and everything. Yeah. And there's, you know, in stereotypes and in comedy, there are hidden truths in those things. Just like I'm sure in your class, you had a tackleberry.
Yeah, yeah. Because we started, I went to the police academy in 2005 in Broward County, and that was when they started introducing wearing gun belts with the blue guns or the red guns and stuff, right, to kind of give the cadets like a feeling of this is what you're going to be wearing every day. Get used to it. Start practicing it. Start learning. Don't let it be the first day on the road when you start planning out and mapping where the things on your belt go. So which was a good idea. And now they've even moved into where some of these academies are wearing vests and stuff, and they're getting, you know, and it's a large investment from the police departments if they're sponsored. You know, when I went, we had to buy our own gear and stuff, and so we had to invest in ourselves to do those things. But you know, there's a lot to it. Yeah.
So we all had the similar experiences. The police academy is basically the same for everybody, and I wanted to describe that and all the things that we have to do, the inspections. And like on day one, after our training advisors were very nice to us and welcomed us to the academy, I was in basic law enforcement class 84 mm-hmm. at Miami-Dade College North. Since then, we have our own academy at Miami-Dade Police at the training center.
Right.
But every police department in Dade County sent their cadets or recruits to Miami-Dade College. So after the niceties and stand up and tell us why you want to be a police officer and all that, you know, nice touchy-feely stuff, our two TAs said this to us, which was one of the biggest lessons they could have given us right off the bat. Understand that you can get seriously hurt or killed doing this job. And if you can't deal with that concept, get up and walk out so we don't waste our time and money training you.
Huge.
Fortunately, nobody got up and walked out. We did lose a couple of guys during training. But then right after all that, outside, move your asses, hit the floor, give me 20, you know, mm-hmm. and then as I describe it, you know, the physical training, parentheses, torture began, right? Yeah. And we all go through that.
Yeah.
There's not a single academy in the country that doesn't do that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to describe all those things early on.
That's a huge thing, and it's interesting that it's stuck with you, and I don't know if people still say that sort of thing, because you know, for me nowadays, we've had people most recently is within the last month or two leave in field training in the beginning right out of the academy saying that they don't feel that it's safe, and it's like, What did you really think you were signing up for? What were you getting into? What kind of job did you think this was? I mean, in the academy, they show you some of this stuff. It's a static environment. It's a safer environment. But, you know, you're learning defensive tactics. You're learning how to shoot. Like, what did you think you were getting into? You know, so, you know, and you put that in the book, and it's something that stuck out for sure. So
it was such an important lesson for us. And I know a lot of the training advisors in our current academy, and they do the same thing, which is good. But the recruit coming in, you have to understand that this job requires sacrifice, okay? Up and all the way to maybe your life, mm-hmm. right? Now, I never walked out of the house thinking I wasn't going to come back, okay? Did I have fear? Sure. I've been in situations mm-hmm. where I went, holy crap, you know, wow, I can't believe we made it out of that one, right? But I always relied on my training and the people I was with, right, to get us through. And every cop goes through that. So I wanted to send that message through the book to the would-be cadet and to the people that don't truly understand who we are. This is what we go through. And yes, to touch on your point, we are being trained to possibly take a life, mm-hmm. okay? And when the chips are down and something happens, this is the other side of the media side of this, you train us to go out there and police and take the bad guys, and it goes sideways. And then it looks really bad on TV, mm-hmm. right? Well, what did you think was going to happen, right?
Yeah.
You know, Mike Tyson said it best. You know, everybody has a plan A and they get punched in the mouth.
Yeah.
Well, in the military, the same thing. Plan A goes to hell really quick. You better have a plan B and a plan C. But people look at us and go, whoa, that looks terrible. Look at the cops. What are they doing? Oh, they're beating that guy, or are they shot and killed? This is police work.
Yeah.
Right? And I wanted to send that message throughout the entire book, starting with how we're trained in the academy, shooting at the targets, right? And I covered blue targets as opposed to the old black ones we used to shoot at.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't have that.
Correct.
Right? Because everything evolves. Police work evolves. So at the time in the academy, we were shooting at black silhouettes. Also at the time, we had a very active state attorney in Janet Reno that liked indicting police officers. No matter what the incident was, throw an indictment. Mm-hmm. Well, some of the thought process at the time was that police officers are predisposed to shoot black people because we practice on black targets. And we heard that and we go, well, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Because the target is a static target, like you said, it's a silhouette. We're under a lot of stress in training to learn how to shoot, for those of us that never did, and hit the target and pass.
Yeah.
We're not thinking this is a person, right? This is just a piece of paper target. So we transitioned to the blue ones. And as I said in the book, I don't know about you, but I've never shot a Smurf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
True. So we went from black to blue targets, and it's like, okay, it's still a static target. Even though it looks, you know, it's standing there like this.
I'm a little teapot.
And then some of the targets we have, as you know, they're holding a gun on you when the target turns or something like that. And fortunately, the training has gotten better over the years, from very rudimentary training to more advanced. And the firearms guys learned when we're actually shooting at the targets, they would say, instead of watch your targets, you know, and the target would turn or go, they would say gun.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the street, it's the gun that's prompting you to shoot, or the knife or the baseball bat, right? And trying to get in the mindset of, that's a gun, I better have my gun out, you know, I better do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the training has evolved, it's gotten better. But it was always blue, black targets, you know.
Yeah,
it's a head scratcher.
You're really, you know, stretching things out, trying to, like, you know, really you're making a case that's not necessary, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's unnecessary, but it happens so much, and that's what I've I've tried to express to people, you know, maybe not in the role of like a public information officer speaking on behalf of a department, but, you know, individually when you speak to friends on social media and stuff like that, that the job is violent. We are grown to not want to be arrested. We play cops and robbers as kids. We play tag as kids, not even like a law enforcement policing type thing. We run away from threats or things. So people just in themselves don't want to be arrested most times. Like, you know, you don't want to get punished. So when 99% of the people that you encounter that are supposed to be arrested for committing a crime or are suspected of committing a crime, they don't want to be arrested. So what do you do when you don't want to be arrested? You fight. You have to fight. And, you know, we have to overpower. We have to take that person into custody. We want to be safe for ourselves. We want to be safe for the person, you know. Right. So it's violent, and it doesn't look good. There's not an easy way to present these things to the public that doesn't live their life that way.
That's why it had to be the truth, mm-hmm. because the truth sometimes stings, right? Mm-hmm. The title of the book, The Real Greatest Show on Earth, what is it out there that we do? What is it most akin to? Well, it's a circus. Mm-hmm. That's what came to mind.
Right.
We're the ringmasters, and this is the circus out there. So that's how I got the title. My chapters are called acts, like a circus act, mm-hmm. not a chapter. And then the scenes contained within each one is a scene, like a theatrical scene yeah. one, scene two, and scene three. So I maintain that theme. So one of those topics you just hit on, use of force.
Yep.
How is use of force determined for police? Well, first of all, it starts with state law, right?
Yeah.
So I say, Justin, you're under arrest for domestic battery or the suspended driver's license. Let's go, you know, it could be murder. It doesn't matter. Once the decision, and people don't understand, the decision to arrest is made, and we inform the subject that you're under arrest. That's it. You have to comply with our orders. Mm-hmm. People don't want to, like you said.
Yeah, they don't.
So how do you affect the arrest on somebody that doesn't want to be arrested? Well, if they start to resist, if it's minor resisting, completely described in that chapter, we have hands and we grab and we manipulate. And then if they decide to fight us, well, we escalate because the law says we can use the force necessary to effect the arrest up into including deadly force. Mm-hmm. So as the subject escalates, we escalate higher because we have to gain control. There is no losing in this situation, yeah. right? Like in Top Gun, no points in second place in yeah. combat, right? So we are allowed to do those things that always ends up on TV and looks horrible. The problem we have in our current society, especially with the media and social media, is that things get edited and they only show you what they want you to see. They don't show you the whole story. How did the officers get there? Why was that use of force used? Well, 99% of the time, if you look at the whole picture, it was completely justified.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look good. And people are taken aback. So that was one of the things that I wanted to cover in there. I covered the state law about that in Florida, which in all states are similar laws. I just happen to use Florida for us. So that use of force is a big, important chapter. And I cover the use of physical force, batons, the taser, mm-hmm. all the way up to firearms and how we got yeah. there.
There's a lot, and there's just so much that goes on with, you know, presenting it. Cause like I was on that side where I had to present it to the media and try to explain some of that stuff. And as you said, the social media, because there's countless channels that are just, and now we're providing it because we're recording it via body cam. So we're giving them the best, you know, like before it just used to be the TV show Cops and stuff that was showing what work was being done. And that was somewhat edited for TV. But now you're getting, I call it like the Matrix, you know, 360 degrees. You can kind of blink, 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 and go camera to camera every angle of what's going on. And you know, we work hard to try and explain that to the public and try and bring in people from our communities to learn about police work. But it's a slow drip, and there's just such a heavy amount of content being created on a daily basis, because every city, every town you're in, we're creating content because we're going to calls. I come back from a weekend and I just look at the amount of call numbers that have been created. You know, I left and it was 2,198. And then I get back to work on Monday and it's 23, you know, whatever. Like, it's like, oh man, there was 300, there was 400 calls for service that are generated. And how many of those are an arrest? How many of those end up being a violent takedown because the person decides to fight because they didn't want to go to jail? So it, the use of force is out there, and it happens, and we've got to go home at the end of the day and be safe and make sure that we're not hurt, and we've got to make sure that people aren't hurt, the person we're arresting.
That's one of the things that is a theme throughout the book for me, because it's in our DNA, our training. Officer safety comes first.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be safe first. We're going to get hurt. I've been hurt many times.
Yeah.
I was even bitten by a subject with AIDS, which is another story. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is one of the things that I try to explain to people, that we're there to handle your situation, but we're going to do it keeping our safety in mind first. Your safety is there, but it comes second to ours, because if we get hurt, we can't help anybody.
Yeah.
Right. And you touched on the cameras. I have a chapter on the body cameras because it became such a phenomenon, and it started in England, and then finally came here to the States in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So Miami-Dade Police, just like all the other agencies, and saw the writing on the wall that eventually there's going to be laws saying police have to wear body cameras, mm-hmm. right? And now everybody's wearing a body camera.
Yeah.
So we knew it was coming. It took 3 years for us to get the program off the ground, with a whole host of problems, you know, especially with the size of MDPD.
Size of the agency, yeah.
All those cameras, and then all the issues of the right camera, and they break or they break down, and then the storage.
Storage is insane. Yeah. That's the thing the public doesn't recognize, is the public records laws in the state of Florida, how long you have to maintain the footage. Some of it, it's a benign call that you just go to, gets wiped after 30 days. But if it gets tagged for a certain reason, an arrest or a specific report or a complaint, those have to be maintained. And then maintained when you've got sometimes four officers that show up, five officers, you know, we like to hang out with each other. Sometimes we need backup, you know, so it's right. more. So, yeah.
Yeah. When we were told the cameras were coming, I didn't look at it as a negative, all right? Be frank about it. And I told my colleagues, I counseled my officers, said, listen, accept it. Number one, you're not going to have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
MDPD is going to be wearing cameras. Number two, it's going to finally show the public and the activists and the media exactly what we deal with. So it started to have that effect. And it especially came in handy for use of force reports for supervisors like me, where if my guys got involved in something, now I can look at the camera footage and see exactly what happened. Because in the heat of battle, the officers might forget something that they did.
Mm-hmm.
They hit them this way, they grabbed them that way, or they got hit and don't know they got hit, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't feel it with the adrenaline going. I've been punched quite a few times. And then the other guys will tell me, yo, you got hit in the head. I go, I don't know.
Or your ears are all swollen up, right, or something like that, yeah.
So it gave us that to look at before we actually typed anything on paper. The other side of it, which was really good, was the BS complaints made against personnel,
mm-hmm.
where someone would complain, say, Officer Yarborough called me a racial epithet,
mm-hmm.
right? Whatever it was. Okay, so the first thing our internal affairs unit does is pull the footage from the body cameras. And then they call the person in that made the complaint and say, okay, you made a complaint against Officer Yarborough. You said he said this. All right, I'm going to show you something. And then they take the laptop and they open it up and they hit play and they say, this is Officer Yarborough's camera footage of your encounter. I went through the whole thing. Now I want you to tell me where he called you that name.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see that, no, there's no name calling there. And then the internal affairs investigator would say, okay, he didn't call you the name. Now, you can retract your complaint, or I can arrest you for filing a false report.
False report, yeah, yeah.
Right? And then they go away.
Yeah.
For those marginal officers that do that stuff, fine. Discipline them, whatever the case is, right?
Yeah,
because we shouldn't be saying things like that. But it does help get rid of a lot of the BS complaints. So the cameras for us was actually a positive.
Right.
Right? And the biggest camera editing issue case that's happened, Rodney King.
Mm-hmm.
So the public saw the LA officers beating Rodney King at the end of this with the batons.
Right, right. Yeah, you get the 15 seconds that gets aired on the news, and that's all we see. Because that was predating internet and everything.
Right. But what we didn't see initially that NBC didn't want us to see was the camera footage from the female officer's car where Rodney King was beating her on the hood of her own patrol car.
Mm.
And then the chase ensued that ended up in the beating.
Yeah.
Okay. So they edited that. NBC did that to make a story, right? Mm-hmm. And they blew the whole thing up. Now, let's go to the beating. And I wrote about this. And this is my opinion on the beating,
mm-hmm.
all right? Rodney King is there encircled by 20-something cops with the smaller group of cops that are actually hitting him, right? Mm-hmm. So he's standing up. He's resisting. They're hitting him. He went down on a knee, and they kept hitting him. That's where they made the mistake, my opinion. My humble but experienced opinion. What they should have done, which we do in Florida, especially in South Florida, you got the football. We're just going to tackle you. There's no knife. There's no gun. We're just going to tackle you, right? The scrum is going to take place. You're going down. We're going to overwhelm you with bodies. You can't fight anymore, and you're going to jail, maybe via the hospital or fire rescue, because lumps are going to be administered in any kind of physical altercation. So I think that's where they made the mistake of standing there continually hitting him with the batons.
Yeah.
Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that in state law, they were tried and they were acquitted because they followed state law and department procedure at the time. Where they got convicted was a civil rights violation federally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think had they just tackled him when he stopped, right, and overwhelmed him, number one, we probably never would have heard about the case, right?
Yeah.
So my big thing is in use of force, how did the officers get there? You've got to wait for the whole investigation, right? And we don't do that here in this country. We jump to conclusions, which is an Olympic sport now.
Yeah, yeah. Right? We show the sensational headline, and then I see it on World News every night. It's they tease it before the commercial, and they come back and they basically say the 15 words, but they add like five more, and then they're like, now we're back to commercial. And it's like, you had no information on this. There's no information on this situation that you just basically, for the lesser mind, in my opinion, inflamed. You just made somebody upset, the headline reader. You just made them upset. And then now they're going to run off to social media or run off to a coffee date with a friend. And did you see those LA officers, beating that guy? And I just know from my experience that to have a group like that wailing away with batons, it's freaking dangerous because we hit each other. And I don't want to be involved in one of those situations. I'd much rather, he's got the ball, like you said, get the ball and just everybody jump on him, grab a limb, get him in custody.
Right.
And then now post George Floyd, let's focus on making sure this guy can breathe, that they're positioned correctly. I mean, I know that from college, you got a drunk friend on the ground. You make sure they're not going to asphyxiate themselves if they throw up, or, you turn them to their side, you make sure they're sleeping correctly, or you make sure they're near a toilet or whatever. I mean, that's old college rules that I used to play by. So it's like, and it rolls into an arrest. We know from the academy, when you've been handcuffed in the back, it's uncomfortable. It stinks. It's sometimes if you're a bigger bodied person, it's definitely not comfortable, or right. you need a second set of cuffs. And so anyways, the George Floyd thing's completely, you mentioned way back, you threw a Top Gun, you said Top Gun, and you have the nickname moniker Maverick. Tell me about where Maverick comes from.
So in 1988, dating, going back into 87, my partner and I were at war with one of our lieutenants. We were just the two first. This guy was a micromanager and a big ego, and you know, and he made life on the afternoon shift very difficult for all of us. So I have a tendency to be outspoken, especially when I was younger, right? More balls than brains, right? And so he didn't like me. And then I had a complaint filed against me. And another story. Don't need to get into it, but it was a BS complaint. And at the time, our internal affairs didn't investigate personnel complaints of discourtesy. The in-house supervisors from your district did that. Mm-hmm. Well, guess who's in charge of this complaint? Okay. Right? This guy. So I got a 5-day suspension. I lost it on appeal because I was supposed to. Mm-hmm. And 3 weeks after I served my 5-day, I got transferred to the Midwest district. I said, okay. I went to the Midnight Field Training Squad, run by Sergeant Jim Pappy Slack, right? Well, everybody in that squad had a nickname from Top Gun. That was their call signs for each other.
Yeah.
And then on the radio, on the non-dispatcher talk channels, right, the tactical channels, they would call each other by their call signs and everything, so... that's pretty cool, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a great squad. And they said, well, Bert, you know, you're coming to our district with a reputation for having been in trouble and doing things your own way. You're Maverick.
Broke the hard deck. Yeah.
And it stuck. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So.
And they didn't have a Maverick.
They didn't have a Maverick.
You right? fit right in.
I did.
Yeah. You parked it right there.
And Pappy, our sergeant, Jim Slack. Pappy was from the Black Sheep, Pappy Boynton, the leader of the Black Sheep during World War II, the VMF 214 squadron in the South Pacific. So he was the leader of the Black Sheep, and we were the Black Sheep. And the Maverick name stuck, and then I became known as Officer Maverick, and later on when I got promoted, it was Sergeant Maverick. So all these many years later, my son would encounter, you know, he'd meet somebody, and they'd realize who he is, and they'd go, oh, you're Maverick's kid, right? So to me, it's a badge of honor. Yeah. It's my alter ego, I think, in a good way. We're all, you know, a little cocky and arrogant at times. Mm-hmm. It's cops, right? But it became the name that I use now for my company.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just, it fit me because even as a kid in high school, I didn't go with the crowd. Mm-hmm. I did what I wanted to do my way or what was good for me. Mm-hmm. Now, when they say, you know, you have a reputation for doing things your own way, let me qualify that statement. I was outspoken. I didn't like stupid decisions or weak supervisors, so then I would say things, which would get me into trouble.
Yeah.
But I followed the rules. I did my job very well. I was a good cop. It's just because I got that reputation of pushing back all the time. Maverick, right? Yeah, like you said, I broke the hard deck.
Yeah.
You know. So that's how that came about. And it's just, you know, my alter ego, who I've become, you know, so to speak.
That's awesome. Let's take a quick break. But when we get back, I want to talk to you about egos and cop egos and kind of where that goes, because I've got feelings about that myself. So let's take a quick break. I'm going to check the cameras and then we'll be right back.
What's in the cup? Guys, what's in my cup? Blackout Coffee Company. We joined up with them. I've been drinking it and I enjoy it, and I think you may enjoy it as well. So you can go over to our website and click the link, or you can just go to their website, blackoutcoffee.com, and use our coupon code to get 10% off. The code is DSP10. So go over, check it out.
All right, we're back, and I think all the cameras are still working. So when we left off, I want to talk about egos, because it's it's in your book, and it's a positive thing. And then sometimes I think it can be a negative thing where it's detrimental and it ends up affecting us, kind of like with the body cams and stuff like that. Talk to me about egos and kind of what you talked about in the book.
So we all have egos. Mm-hmm. And in our profession, just like fire in the military, maybe police in the military a little bit more, but fire has a similar structure to us. So we all have egos. We have to have a strong ego in order to do our job and also control the things and people around us. You have to have that. You can't be weak. Mm-hmm. And you have to order people around in order to gain control of a situation, whatever the case is. Within the ranks, when you become a supervisor, okay, a lot of people kind of start to lose where they came from, their perspective, mm-hmm. that now you're a supervisor. And this happens in every vocation. I don't care what it is, hospital work, you know, business, working for Walmart as a store manager or up the chain or whatever it is. You need an ego to do the job, but then some folks take it a little bit too far and think that they're the end all to everything. And we find that a lot in police work. Mm-hmm. Guy becomes a sergeant, he becomes a lieutenant or a captain or a major, or whatever the case is. And now they think they're above you or better than you. And we're really all just the same. But the ego also drives poor decision making at times. You think you know better than everybody else, mm-hmm. right? Where one of the valuable lessons I've learned, and I was a supervisor, I was a sergeant for 22 of my 37 years, right? I got promoted with 15 years on, so I already had a lot of experience.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, I was on the job 3 years and got promoted. You're not ready to be a sergeant at 3 years. I don't care whatever, no. any agency or whatever, because yeah. you have to lead now that den of lions that you came from, because mm-hmm. that's what we are. You know, we're all alpha dogs or alpha yeah. males or alpha females. And now you're in charge of that group, and you've got to learn how to handle all those personalities without stepping on all those personalities. Mm-hmm. And you've got to let people be people and have their opinion and voice and vent, you know, at times. But when you think that you know better than everybody else, well, you don't. Officers that have been on my squads, a lot of them, especially older officers, they come with a lot of experience on their own, right? So they were in specialized units that I wasn't in. So mm-hmm. when I had a question about something, I can go to them and go, what do you think about this? I never worked in your unit, so tell me about this. We got this issue coming up. How are we going to address it? And you let everybody become part of the decision-making process. In tactical, critical situations, you got to dictate. You got to give orders, right? It's happening now. You take that position, you take that position, you go do this, you go do that. You got to do that in emergencies. But when you have time, let your people be involved. Mm-hmm. And when that ego comes in, that you know better than everybody else, then the rest of us will just, you know, we'll just sit back and why don't you handle it then?
Yeah.
Okay? Because yeah, yeah. you know better.
Right.
Even though we've been doing this for a very long time and we've had great success, or we've made mistakes and learned from those mistakes. See, if you don't learn from your mistakes, your ego's in the way.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah, I see it so much, and that's how we get ourselves in trouble, either internally, like you're talking about, or externally out in the field. You know, when you think you know, or you want to do something and your ego just doesn't allow you to, you know, take some egg on the face or some humble pie and say, you know what? I didn't think about it that way. You're right. And some of us don't listen. Like, we tune out what people are saying, what our bosses are saying, or what our subordinates are saying, or the public. And we end up, our egos end up getting in the way sometimes. And that kind of gets me upset when I watch things online or videos, you know, like we call them training videos. And it's like, man, if the ego had just let a little bit of information in that we may not be at this point where we're watching this video or we're listening to this story and training, you know.
That sergeant I mentioned, Jim Pappy Slack, mm-hmm. best supervisor I ever had, hands down. And this is how it started. When I got transferred to that district after getting kicked out of Southwest District, and here I am with my tail between my legs, right? Yeah. I'm the new guy. I'm the FNG. And now I've got to try to fit in. And I came with this baggage and everything. The very first night, he took me aside after roll call. And he said, I've heard some things, but I want you to know you've got a clean slate with me. Okay? We're starting fresh. And the weight that was lifted off of my shoulders and I could breathe again, right?
Yeah.
And he let me prove myself to the good cop that I was. And in that first week, I caught a bunch of bad guys, you know, because I was out doing police work at night. Mm-hmm. And he goes, on the scene of a stolen vehicle with a bailout with three guys, we set up a perimeter after I chased the vehicle. He came to the scene, of course, as a sergeant should, and he says, you know, I don't see a problem with you. When I mentioned the supervisor's name that I had a problem with, he goes, say no more.
Enough said. Yeah.
Right? Because reputations travel far and wide, you know, across mountain ranges, mm-hmm. you know, and rivers, you know, and in a department, there are no secrets, mm-hmm. right? We have a lot of districts in Miami-Dade Police and a lot of bureaus. It's huge, but there are no secrets, right? That one reputation travels all over the place. So two examples. One was, I got a new commander, and I was in the general investigations unit of this station. So it was the detective unit, and I had the specialized enforcement team, which was the uniform component, the tactical squad, where we went and got the bad guys for the detectives, right? 2 months it took for this commander to meet the detective unit. 2 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
So during that meeting, he droned on for 20-something minutes about himself. And he talked about how he had an undergraduate degree in organizational leadership. Okay, now I knew this guy when he was an officer, when he was a sergeant, when he was a lieutenant, when he was a captain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So at the end of the 23 and a half minutes, that last 30 seconds, he said, I have a plan. And if you're not with my plan, I'm going to get rid of you. So what do you think all those detectives remember from that meeting?
That one thing. The
threat.
Yeah.
The threat, right? Okay. Fine. Things didn't go well in that district, and the district went down immediately, right? I was at my brother's wedding, and since I worked in the intracoastal area, the North Miami Beach area of Dade County, I worked with a lot of municipalities. One of them was North Miami, City of North Miami. And at my brother's wedding, there was a North Miami officer there, and he came up to me and he said, hey, I'm about to get promoted to sergeant. I know you from work and you have a good reputation. You have any pointers for me? I said, sure, thank you. You know, I appreciate that. I'm flattered. He said, well, I'm going to get my squad and I'm just going to cut them loose. And I said, stop right there. Don't do that. Yeah, and he did exactly. Mm-hmm. He goes, well, what do you mean? I said, you can't do that with cops. Maybe very seasoned, experienced guys that just go out and do their job, right? And they know what they're doing, and they require very little supervision. But you're going to be a new sergeant. Chances are you're going to have young officers on your first squad,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you're not going to get the pick of the litter as a brand new sergeant, right? You're going to go to midnights or afternoons with Tuesday and Wednesday off, or, you know, some bad shift. I said, you're going to have young guys. Don't cut them loose. Tell them who you are. They're already going to know who you are when you take the squad, because North Miami is just one station, mm-hmm. right? Everybody knows each other. They're already going to know about you. But you can tell them what your vision is for the squad, just like we all do, you know. Mm-hmm. But don't go in there thinking you're going to save the world and you're going to change all these things. Sit back and watch. Talk to these guys. Be there for them, all right? When you show up on a scene, there's going to be scenes as a sergeant you're required to show up on. There's going to be other scenes you're going to go, maybe I should go by,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, or an officer is going to call you, Sarge, maybe you need to come by on this one, yeah. right? Because you can't be everywhere at once. And I said, be there. Say, I'm here to back you up. All right. And if you need me, let me know. But don't cut them loose and don't lead from the back. Mm-hmm. Lead from the front. Okay. That whip that a lot of supervisors in police work, the military, fire, and other places like to use to crack that whip. I said, no. The example I use and I put in the book is extend the whip out behind you and tell them to grab it and pull them with you. Okay?
Yeah.
And do your own work. Don't start a case and dump it on your officers. All right? Nobody likes that. I had lieutenants that thought sergeants were their secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would dump all their administrative work on us. No.
Right.
I have my own duties and responsibilities. I have to supervise my squad. And I got enough paperwork just for them. I'm not doing your work for you. One of the reasons, you know, I'm outspoken and I'm a pain in the ass, right?
Yeah.
But you have to be that way. So do your own work. If you start a case, finish your case. If you're going to arrest somebody, you do the A form, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't give it to one of your officers to do. Whatever it is, finish it. And when you're off, and in a tactical situation, be the first guy through the door.
Mm-hmm.
Because if your officers see that, they're going to follow you anywhere. It's going to take a little while. But if they see that you're the first one in the door and you're leading from the front, they'll walk through fire for you.
Very true.
Right? So the ego has got to be put in the pocket. Okay. While it's necessary in order to do our jobs, it can go too far. And I don't know what it is about our profession, but sometimes the higher you go, that ego gets inflamed, right? And it gets worse with every rung up the corporate ladder. One was so bad that I had this major at a station where you literally would say, "Good morning, Major," at the front desk, and he would ignore you.
Yes.
Because he didn't speak to anybody below the rank of lieutenant. And it's like, I'm acknowledging the presence of my station commander. You know, good morning, sir. How are you? And he'd turn around and walk away. And I go, what an arrogant.
Yeah.
I don't know what the rules are for a podcast, but I got
Doesn't matter.
Few choice words.
Yeah.
But what an arrogant prick.
Yeah.
Right? So who the hell do you think you are? Remember, you started off just like me.
Yeah.
Everybody in MDPD and most agencies start off as a patrol officer and go up the ranks.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's frustrating at times.
No doubt. No, it's the egos, I fear, you know, like I said, get in our way internally and externally and sometimes create problems for us. And sometimes we just have to, you know, take a step back, think about it for a second. There's few, like you said, when you're in a tactical situation and decision needs to get made, you can question it later on and Monday morning quarterback and figure stuff out later. But you know, get the job done when you need to. Rely back on your training and experience, and that's like you mentioned early on when you walk out of the house every day, you weren't scared. You weren't worried that you weren't going to make it back home. And I feel like I'm the same way where I. So much I know is programmed into me through autopilot and stuff that I get out there and it's at the end of the day, I go, how the hell did I do that? You know, some of these days, you know, like when you're running call to call, you're juggling everybody's issues and stuff like that. You know, I'm talking about the customers out in the world that we're dealing with. And, you know, it's just your training. And that's why it's really important to pay attention to all the stuff that you can learn and soak everything in and sponge it all up. And for people, you know, starting the job, it's great information in here. I've got a bunch of bookmarks in it and things that if I had more time in here, my meter's running out, that we could probably talk for hours on end. But I know that everybody has the opportunity to read the book and check it out. Let me know where they can get it. And then where can they find you? Because you're starting up your own podcast. So where can they get the book? And then where can they find you?
The book is available Amazon, like everything else in our in our universe, right?
Done. Enough said.
Barnes & Noble, Walmart.com.
Okay.
And, you know, other select places, but Amazon seems to be the go-to place for everybody.
And it's where Amazon got their start. Was it was an online bookstore?
Exactly, so, exactly.
You know, that's a good place. I have a guy, Scott, that's been on the show. He published it direct through Amazon. He did just basically where you upload it, they printed it, and that's the main thing. So, but this one's through a publishing house, so it's cool.
Yeah, Jeb Wizard Publishing. Joe is a retired Providence police captain who's been a writer all his life. And like me, had trouble getting published. And all right, so I'm unfiltered. I always, you know, say what's on my mind. Writing the book was easier than getting it published.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So when I finished writing the book and I went, oh, it's done, okay. This is great, right? Yeah. And I had fun writing it. Now it's time to get published. So I started looking for a publisher. And all the big publishing houses will not speak to you. They will not accept manuscripts from you. They tell you right on their website you have to go through a literary agent. Okay. So I started researching literary agents. I must have sent over 60 introductory emails to literary agents.
Sheesh.
All right. The couple of polite replies that I got were polite turndowns.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the midst of all this anti-police sentiment in the country, you know, and the media world, publishing is just as liberal as Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody wanted to touch me, you know, and that's my take on it. You know, police bad, we're not going to touch it right now. It was in the wake of George Floyd and all that. So then I said, okay, after months of this frustration, let me start looking for conservative publishers. That's how I found Joe. He started his own publishing company just so he can get published because nobody would touch him.
Oh,
so that's how our relationship came together.
Yeah, cool.
And that's how it happened. So it's a labor of love. And Joe did say this to me. He goes, getting a book published would be the closest thing a man comes to having a baby.
Painful and
yes,
yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
So, but it's finally here, it's finally done. You know, the folks that have read it, they're really enjoying it, police and civilian alike. I'm having no name, nobody knows me, you know, it's hard to get it out there, you know. So, and it's one of the, you know, thank you for bringing me on to talk about the book,
of course.
The one other thing I did was the Channel 4 interview with Elliot Rodriguez.
Right, you sent me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which went really well. My wife Rosie and I were there, and it was a great experience. My first time doing anything like it. Mm-hmm. And now, leading into what you were alluding to, yes, I'm starting my own podcast, and it's going to be called Sergeant Maverick, the podcast, all things police work, politics, and life.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be up and running in just a couple of weeks. My son, BJ, Burt Jr., is my engineer.
Cool.
He has his own podcast, by the way, called Vice City Gamers.
Plug. Yeah.
Right? And it's all with the they had caricatures of them made with Miami Vice colors and suits and everything. But he's been doing it now with a couple other cops. And they do it all remote on theirs. But he knows the business like you do. And I'm the talker. He's the engineer.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. You gotta, there's a lot that a lot of people don't understand that goes into this stuff. You know, I post once in a while behind the scenes on the Instagram stories and stuff, but, there's a lot of, backwork digital, and it's not just the editing, it's to get the publishing of the audio onto like Spotify and stuff like that. If you're just going to do audio, because podcasts are long. People can't sit here and watch these videos on YouTube that we put up. You know, they're driving around, or they're officers and they want to listen in their cars, so they look to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all of them. So there's you know, producer work that you got to do too. So, and that's, you know, I'm familiar with that. And so that's why the donut shop just, you know, keeps on trucking, and here we are. So, you know, I appreciate you coming on. This is awesome. And I look forward to jumping on yours and,
absolutely.
And checking out you guys.
I want to reciprocate, and, you know, I'm going to have a variety of topics, on the podcast. Like I said, it'd be called, Police Work, Politics, and Life. So we're going to talk about police stuff, and then we're going to get into current issues with politics, because I'm a political animal. Mm-hmm. I love presidential politics.
Yeah.
And as I wrote in the book, most cops are conservative by nature, mm-hmm. right? Law and order and stuff. Yeah. But you can have any opinion you want, okay? And you can, you know, I can have you on the podcast and you can have your opinion and we can go back and forth and all that as long as, you know, we agree to disagree. That's yeah. And that's fine. And then life issues. And some of the things I want to cover, I'm going to have family on to talk about what's it like being, like my wife will be the first one, Rosie, to what's it like being married to a police officer, mm-hmm. right? With all the good and the bad and the ugly that comes with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're sometimes a hard pill to swallow. Mm-hmm. My kids, my nieces, you know, what's it like growing up with parents as cops? I'm going to have some others on. I'm going to have firefighter friends on to talk about their jobs and then how we work together and sometimes don't work together,
yeah. right?
Because of the nature of the beast. And then I'm going to have financial issues with my financial advisor on to teach people how to properly invest because we don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then my accountant will come on to talk about tax implications for those investments everybody's earning during mm-hmm. their career and what do you do when you retire.
Yeah.
So it's a bunch of different things. And you know, have it really diverse.
Cool.
But I'm looking forward to having you on, you know, and this has been great. I really appreciate it. My first time doing something like this.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh,
and it's been great. It's been fun.
Yeah. Easy. It's easy. I was, of course, anxious and excited and stuff because this is my first time leading one and hosting it myself. But, you know, here we are and we got to do what we got to do. And just like I said with police work, you just go out there and wing it, man. Just go out there and wing it. You'll figure it out and, you know, just stay alive.
Well, if you say it's just your first time, you're a natural.
Yeah, thank you.
Because it's great.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you. We'll toast this and cheers this to wrap it up. Thank you very much, my friend. And I hope to see everybody out again next time on the next Donut Shop podcast. So thank you very much. Bye.
Calling all units. Donut Shop has a fresh dozen. Go ahead and take a 1040.